ago, you were telling me about your that your book over exposure. It's about a gossip columnist. You are one, really, aren't you?
I am now. I wasn't when I wrote it.
That intrigued me. I thought that was a very strange thought, that you had actually written this thing.
Yeah, it sort of worked backwards. I was a freelance features writer, mainly writing for The Times. I was doing The Herald and I was doing other bits and bobs in The Sunday Times. And I was writing this book at the same time. I was interested in the sort of the phenomenon of gossip columnists, because they're their own little breed. There's a lot of pretense and there's a lot of ego about them. There's a lot of mileage in a character. Basically, a character that's ripe. Every gossip columnist is a character that's ripe for a fall. And so I wrote this book about one, and then turned into one afterwards.
Right, and you didn't. You must have had some sort of aspirations to becoming one, surely? Then
not in that sort of direction. I mean, I don't. I enjoy doing the column I do at the moment enormously, but it's
What is that? It's in the.
It's in the Times. It's the people column in the Times, and it's the Daily Diary. And I enjoy doing it a lot. I miss the features writing. I miss writing longer things, but it's good to learn a new discipline. You deal with 5 or 6 or 7 different stories every day. You need to have a working knowledge of politics, of theatre, of film, of music.
It must involve tons of just networking, really.
Quite a lot of networking. A lot of Googling. But yeah, lots of networking as well.
Is it an unfortunate thing that you've ended up in that same job as your character? Because people, he lives a quite kind of high life there. I mean, he's getting sort of, hammered on a nightly basis. Do people think that it is actually about you, yourself and your own experiences?
Well, there's a pro and a con to it, in that it's been great for the book and publicity for the book, and it's made people much more likely to review it, to write about it, to plug it, all this kind of thing, because doing the job sort of raised my profile as a... As a first novel, it's hard to sell anyway, and it's more interesting if you think, oh, gossip columnist writing a book about a gossip columnist.
Yeah.
The downside is that because I was writing about somebody who had a very different, very different career to what I was doing at the time.
What were you doing? Feature writer.
So I spent my days at home in front of my laptop.
Quiet life,
exactly. Because I was writing about somebody very different from me, I felt much more comfortable exploiting aspects of my life, my background generally, Jewish Scots.
And you were also brought up in Duddingston, weren't you?
I was.
And I
thought I can take all that. That's fine. It's much less work than making him a Irish Muslim or something.
Yeah.
And I can take all that. And because this character is so different from me, no one's going to confuse it for an autobiography.
But now they must be.
Now they must be. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Has that led to some funny situations?
No, not too bad. I've been lucky with it because I hadn't got the job too badly wrong. Nobody seems to have assumed too much it was an autobiography, I think. Or maybe they just quietly think a bit less of me. I don't know.
You bring in a lot of actual celebrities. They don't really say very much, but I suppose it adds a sort of authenticity. How did you choose the ones you did? Were these people that you just seen at a distance then?
It was basically written as stalker fiction. It's written as the kind of thing that you read about when you see magazines and you think, I wonder what that world's like. I'll try and imagine it. If I was writing about a certain kind of party, a very easy way to do that is to reel off 5 or 6 people who are there. If you say, at this party, you've got Sean Connery, Prince Andrew, and somebody else, then that's going to look very different straight away to, at this party, you've got Davina McCall. It's a quick way of capturing tone.
They're like cocktails.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So it's like mixing this and mixing that. Yeah, I see what you were doing there. I mean, I think the book was pretty funny. Do you think of yourself as a funny person?
Funny person?
Well, I mean, do you make people laugh?
I do, a bit. I'm funnier written down than out loud, I think. The thing I can do best as a writer is to write funny. I'm not great at redrafting, and yeah. I'd much rather get it right first time. The ending took a while to get right. Because first it was too negative, and then it was too positive. And then I had this idea. I wanted to nail down the sort of genre plot, you'd call it, the detective story that runs through it. I thought if that's nailed down perfectly, I can have as many loose ends as I want elsewhere. And I like loose ends.
I
like the fact that there are characters, you don't find out what happened to them, and they fall in and they fall out, which is what happens in life.
It's funny that I would say I have quite mixed feelings about that. In that sort of book, I think that worked well, perfectly all right. I agree with what you're saying, but there are some books where I really would want things to be pinned down, at least in some sort of way, not necessarily in finding out what happens to them, but that they do perform, they've got to perform a function, actually. Even when you say you leave loose ends there, I suppose actually even those characters are performing a function.
Oh, absolutely.
Aren't they? They're creating atmosphere and...
Yeah, but a lot of them, well, several of them, the main function they perform is that they fall out of the book and it's like they were never there. And all these, I mean, there's the character of Carolyn, if you remember, she's in it towards the end, and she, well, she's in it right the way through, but he leaves her in a house when she's obviously in a mess, and you never find out what happened to her. And he speaks to her friends, and they barely even remember who she was.
Because you're dealing with what you might call a superficial world.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where people are really rushing from a bit of social display to the next. Often, your main character is completely off his face.
Yeah.
Then that sort of thing is acceptable to me as a reader, because it's part of that atmosphere that you're creating.
It's the narrator's experience.
It's true to that. You know, that's something you wake up 6 months later and say, oh my God.
Yeah.
What was that? I'd never got back. You know, or whatever. You know, an author can say, well, I like loose ends, but I don't think that is necessarily enough. You know, it's all right if it fits the book. It's what makes the demands.
Yeah,
on what you do.
Well, up to a point. I mean, because I was thinking what you were saying. Like, I think even if you had a plot that takes, you know, place in a little village where everybody knows everything about everybody, I tend to like less novels that are just snapshots of time. You know, you want to know why this particular bit of time is important, and it's because some sequence of events goes from A to B. But for it to be realistic, there's other sequences of events going from A to B, and all the B's might not tie up in the same place.
It's a funny sort of take on everyday life, though, isn't it, being a writer? Is there something about your personality you would say that made you a writer? You know, you always kind of got a writer's eye on events and rush off and put them in a journal or something.
No, I've never really managed to keep a journal or a diary or anything like that. I like seeing things and thinking, well, that's funny and that's interesting, and then being able to tell somebody about it. Yeah, I suppose that's the kind of thing that appeals.
The book certainly did make me laugh. I also like the fact that it reminded me of these Edwardian detective, gentleman detective things, and Raffles and so forth. And I think E. Phillips Oppenheim as well. I used to read quite a lot of these writers. And in fact, I was Googling, and that was the first time I did realise that Hornung was the brother-in-law of Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah. And you know, they had quite a fight about Raffles. Hornung wanted to dedicate the book to Conan Doyle, and Conan Doyle wasn't happy because he didn't like the way that the Raffles Tales, basically a villain is the hero, and he was like incredibly worried about this. He thought this was a really destructive, nasty thing, a really irresponsible thing to do.
In Overexposure, I don't think that applies to your central character, actually.
I think
the reverse rather does, because to me, it struck me that it was this very sort of latter-day coming of age, well, not latter-day, but he was a bit old to be... Mm-hmm. what you could call a coming-of-age book.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was like he was in his late 20s and, you know, still feeling himself to be about, whatever, 19 or 20. I hadn't thought much about his own mind and where he was at in life and what he valued. And there's a sort of love theme, which I thought was rather sweet. So it was, he'd always assumed that he was going to get together with this girl.
Yeah.
But that was the sort of person he was. He took a lot for granted. But in that case, he actually could take...
It wasn't
so much taking it for granted. It was one of those odd instinctive things that
he'd basically decided. I think quite a lot of people do, but he thought he'd figured out everything about his life when he was 16, and thereafter he was just waiting for it all to fall into place. And then he discovers, you know, whatever, 15 years later, that he doesn't actually still want all these things that he thought he wanted then, except for that love story.
Yeah, I mean, you don't spell that out either, do you?
No.
That's quite what really is going to happen. But it's more that certain things come into focus in his mind. He also loses his job, doesn't he, at the very end? I don't think that's giving away too much, really.
No, I think that's fine.
And I did get the impression he was meant to have... You know, he was certainly set on a different course. In fact, he was possibly... I thought he was maybe going to turn into a writer.
I can't imagine what would happen to that character afterwards. It's outside of my experience, if you see what I mean. I wouldn't be able to write about it. I think if I could write... I mean, I'm a very sort of happy and stable person in life, but I think if I could write about what happened to him next, continuing on that happy trajectory, then that would be, you know, that would be the answer to life, the universe and everything, I think, you know, if that makes any sense.
When you were reading it through, why did you decide, oh, this is too negative an ending to have her?
The first ending was too... It was too bleak, and it concentrated on the negative, and nothing really got properly tied together. and the character ended on too much of a down, and that was just, it was just altogether the wrong tone to end on. I always think a book should leave you a bit happier. It's obviously a type of book that should leave you a bit happier. But
when you're reading yourself, I mean, what sort of books have you been enjoying recently?
I was writing something about writing this book in the Times, and I pointed out Amazon actually recommended my own book to me, which I thought was a major success.
On the basis of your other purchases.
On the basis of my other purchases.
Oh, right, and what were they? That's a good one.
I guess the books I'd bought off Amazon that would have made it recommend. I can't tell you this.
No, you can.
Okay.
If Amazon knows, you know, I mean.
I think it would have been a combination of early Martin Amis, a bit of Bret Easton Ellis, some Christopher Brookmar, William Boyd, bits of Ian Banks, I suppose. There you have a cross section of, you know. And Americans like Mailer. I mean, I really, when I started writing, it probably sounds very odd, but when I first started writing this book, or just before I started writing this book, when I started planning it, I've been reading an awful lot of Norman Mailer. He's got this one, The Deer Park, about this guy who leaves the army and ends up in, he's staying in some little town outside Las Vegas, and it's all casinos and glamour and everything, but very empty, and I suppose that was quite an influence on me.
He's quite a chauvinistic man,
but
incredibly sort of pugnaciously intellectual.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the few writers I read and really enjoy who I think I would not like this man as a person.
Well, it's funny because I once interviewed Dana Attill, who was an editor for many, many years with André Deutsch.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure I'm not making a crossover. It was Norman Mailer she visited. She rather liked him, I think. I don't know, somehow it was connected with a sort of very genial evening in his flat, and
then
walking.
Walking
over, what would it be, the Brooklyn Bridge tour from Manhattan? I can't really remember which way. People often have a very different public persona from their private self or whatever. I mean, you must really notice that, I should think.
Big showbiz stars. The most striking thing about a lot of them is they're exactly like you expect them to be. Someone like Hasselhoff is, you know, probably one of the biggest, David Hasselhoff, one of the sort of biggest names that I've interviewed. He's every bit as utterly insane as he appears to be. You sort of think he must be doing this as an act, not a bit of it. And all the stereotypes are true. All the sort of young Hollywood starlets are a bit dim and very vain. So yeah, I think very few people have a secret life in that sense.
Do you read biographies or autobiographies of older film stars and so forth?
Not as a rule. I did enjoy recently that fictionalised autobiography of Fatty Arbuckle. That was a great, in a great sort of depraved glamour sort of way. But no, I don't read very many biographies.
I went through a spell of reading things by and about people like Mae West and W.C. Fields and Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
And they were just really amazing people. I think Mae West must be one of my... Yeah, I mean, I've been staying up too late recently, and she always says, get to bed early.
Yeah.
She always had a sort of retinue of young men, you know, around her, and she used to... What was it? Cocoa butter was the other thing. She swore by it. Goodness had nothing to do with it. That was her autobiography. Very good. Very funny, actually. I do think these people all had very powerful personalities, really, and I wonder if things have changed. Maybe the movie business is marketing led, a bit like the book business is becoming.
And less personality driven.
And less personality driven.
That would be true, yeah.
Because you could say that about books as well. If the first criterion that you have to fulfil is a certain high level of sales, then it really means that books which might really be very well written, but not have a big market, but maybe have a very long, enduring market, that is irrelevant. You know, you're not really producing books necessarily for the future. You're producing books that have got to turn into the money. Canongate's a firm, they must all have to deal with that to an extent, but Canongate is certainly, in my view, one like an old-fashioned literary publisher.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I was having a conversation with Jamie Bing about this last night. They haven't published many books like my book, or at least many books that can be sold in the way that my book can be sold, in that as a sort of a very much a sort of populist,
sort of
disposable paperback
thing.
Yeah, feedback that I had from Jamie and from Francis was very much that it was because it wasn't just like that. It's because it's a book you can read in two ways. You can read it as the sort of the uncomplicated thriller,
or is it a satire?
Yeah, as the sort of darker satire. Either way,
I enjoyed it. I was reading it in a very different context than what was being described. Mm. The heart of London and all of this very wired newspaper world. And celebrity world. I was in the wilds of Moidart,
right.
in a caravan, and it was disturbed only by a few birds and toads, sort of thing. But it was really nice. It was like an odd thing, like looking this sort of down a telescope backwards to this sort of urban, distant urban place. Yeah, it was quite interesting. Have you ever thought of writing scripts?
I fully intend to at some point. I mean, I've begun scripts. I've never devoted the time to script, but it's my strengths are dialogue. So. It would make sense.
It's your sneaky sense of humour. Quite playful, so that was what I really did enjoy.
I do quite like, though, as well, an obvious joke.
Oh, yeah.
The joke that you see coming. But no, that twisty and sly, I can...
As well as obvious.
I can deal with, yeah.
Twisty, sly and obvious. Mm.
Yeah. it's not really one for the dust jacket, is it?
There is an interview, not an interview, a father and son thing that you with your father, Malcolm Rifkind, have done. And he said that you made him laugh.
That was very, very nice of him. He makes me laugh quite a lot as well. I bumped into, what's her name, Sarah Smith, John Smith's daughter. She's a new reader now. She's Sarah, isn't she?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I bumped into her about when I started this job at one of these parties I'd never been to but only written about. And her father was good friends with my father, although they were on different sides of the house. And she was talking about how there was this whole club of these sort of Edinburgh advocates.
Yeah.
There was them, there was Robin Cook, Ming Campbell, all this lot. And they were all quite, sort of Donald Dewar as well, they were all sort of quite close to each other, despite having completely different, sort of competing views. And I think they're probably all much more similar individuals than a lot of their colleagues in their various parties.
Did you ever think of becoming a lawyer yourself?
No.
Why not? You look as if you're definitely sure of that.
I'm just not very interested.
Was it you knew you'd be some sort of writer or journalist?
I always wanted to be. I didn't for a while when I was at university. I was probably about the only time I've sort of wavered in that. I was aware that I was surrounded by all these people who were much wittier, cleverer, and better writers than me. But they're all management consultants now, so you suddenly see an opening. but yeah, other than that period when I didn't have a clue what I was going to do with myself, I always wanted to write in some way. Yeah.
Have you got another book going just now?
Yes, I've got a couple.
What setting do they have?
One has a setting very similar to Overexposure, which is probably the one I'm going with. I mean, a setting similar, although it's a different.
Do you mean by that sort of journalistic setting or
no,
celebrity and
a sort of contemporary, largely London sort of glamour setting?
Glamour setting.
Because I don't think I'm quite done with that. And the other, I'm quite interested in taking further. There's a bit it touches on Overexposure. There's a bit where it touches on like his grandfather, like being sort of a Edinburgh Jew in the 1920s kind of time.
And he had a kilt shop in the High Street.
I'm very interested in the idea of what it was like then, being this sort of newly established immigrant community. And how, because the way they all, what I remember about my grandparents was just how Scottish they were.
Yeah.
And how, but their grandparents wouldn't have been Scottish at all. And it's just how the two cultures combined.
Yeah, that whole Jewish thing. Do you, your character in Overexposure, he really doesn't identify with it, but his sisters do.
Yeah.
One of them in particular, very much so.
One of them chooses to.
That's
right.
And I wondered, have you gone through any sort of equivocation about all of that, or do you regard that as, where do you see that in your own personal makeup, really?
Well, it's there. It's not colossally important to me. I'm about to marry a Christian German. I'm not.
You are.
I am about to marry a Christian German.
Yeah.
So I'm not. I'm not one of these kind of. I'm not concerned about bringing up my children as Jews or anything like that at all.
No.
But I'm aware of the mindsets I'm formed by, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
And the kind of things I grew up with and all that. So it's quite interesting. I mean, it's Scottish Judaism, I think, is something incredibly interesting. And maybe that's just because I'm a part of it. But it's such a weird and small combination of culture. All the sort of characteristics I'd always assumed were Jewish characteristics aren't at all. They're all entirely Scottish, but they're all based on my sort of Scottish family. And you know, things like just a sort of a restraint and a modesty and a kind of a sort of slight, you know, not for the likes of us kind of mentality. And I'd always thought this was, you know, typical sort of Jewish mindset. Thing, yeah. Of course, it's not even slightly. You know, you go down to London and the Jews are the flashiest people on the planet. And I remember being a bit sort of shocked by this, that they were, you know, but I thought Jews were like this. And of course, it's a very different... To be a Scottish Jew is to be a very different thing to being an English Jew, which I think is quite interesting.
Over a period of about a year and a half or even 2 years, I would go along sometimes when an artist, Joyce Gunner Cairns, she was drawing David Dyke's.
Right.
And of course, this is, you know, towards the end of his mm-hmm. life. And I mean, I got a great deal from that.
Well, I mean, did you ever read his book, The Two Worlds?
Oh, I love that book.
It's an amazing book, yeah.
But a very odd situation there, being the rabbi's son, and then not really taking on that mantle, in a sense, within that tradition, did he?
Well, no, quite the opposite. He really rebelled. The Jewish Edinburgh he talks about, with I think the three synagogues dotted around and all these sort of shops and everything. And I mean, I've seen in my lifetime in Edinburgh the sort of the Jewish community of Edinburgh shrinking from about 1,000 to probably slightly under 300. I'd like to write something about that community when it was at its peak.